Andy, I just wondered if you could say a few words about the future of the space program in general. Where's it going from here?
The next step is the International Space Station next year, which is a collaborative venture between the US, Russia, Europe, Japan, and Canada, and will be to build on the experiences of this program in a new generation space station. After that, I think what's going to happen is that there will be a big push to go to Mars, to bring a human presence to Mars. I think that's probably about 20 years away, and I don't think I'll be in the profession at that point, but I think I'll live to see it. I think that's the next thing that's going to happen. While on board Mir, I can't go into really much more detail than I already have. There were a whole host of experiments. Look at those effects. The data is actually still in analysis, and it's going to take quite some time before it's all pulled together and they make sense of it, because it's not just my experiments, it's also the previous people that flew on it as well, and they've got to try and understand what common trends there are and so on.
How fit did you have to be an astronaut?
Reasonably fit. You don't need to be an Olympic athlete. You need to be reasonably healthy. You've got to be able to pass a flight physical, which is comparable to the kind of flight physical that you'd have to pass to fly a small airplane, for example. So reasonable health and no major medical problems. Not as tough as you might think. John Glenn is going to fly at the end of next month, the end of October, and he's 77.
Andy, were you already a fluent speaker in Russian, or how long did it take you to come up to speed learning Russian at such a level as you could deal with the aeronautical side of things?
Yeah, I got about 6 months of language training in Russian. I've never been fluent in it. I wish I had been. I was never fluent as much as I'd like to have been. I reached a point where I could understand the lectures that I was being given. I could ask questions. I could communicate everything I needed to communicate, perhaps haltingly, but I could. The part that was toughest was while you're together with two cosmonauts in a confined space working together and socializing together, I didn't have the range of language to sort of be spontaneous, make jokes, and that kind of social interaction language. It was kind of a pity.
Andy,
yeah.
You mentioned...
Go ahead.
You mentioned that you didn't see the Great Wall of China.
Right.
What other man-made objects did you see?
You can see lots of things, actually. One thing you see a lot of are jet trails, contrails in the air, like over the Atlantic. You just see these streaks back and forth. Over the Nullarbor out west, you see lots of them. They stand out quite clearly as these thin white lines. You can see cities. Oddly enough, you can't see them much during the day. You look down on a city during the day, it's very hard to make it out. Like you saw Melbourne there. Well, it's not clear on a big screen like this, perhaps, but you couldn't actually make out the city easily. You could make them out very easily at night, though. The city lights stand out very well. I would have a computer going, that computer you saw me working with, and it had a display on there that gave me my ground track, and I could see where I was above the Earth. And I used to look to see when I was coming over Australia, because I'd like to go and look at the view or try and get some pictures of it. The way the orbit worked for us, and because of we were on Russian time, most often I would be coming over Australia at night. And I used to come across the Southern Ocean, and I would be able to see the lights of Adelaide off on the left, and the lights of Melbourne, and the lights of Sydney. And you could see all these. You could see these very clearly, all at the same time. It was really amazing to see the three cities at the same time. And sometimes you could see Brisbane as a glow off on the horizon as well. I never could see Canberra. There was always a dark cloud over Canberra. You can actually also see other features too. You can see some of the, like the railway track across the Nullarbor. You can see that. There's a real fine line stands out. You can see delineated areas where different farming practices are carried out. So you see fence lines and things like that from the change of the colour of the farming principles they have. Those are the sort of things you see mostly. One of the most striking things that I saw was actually not a man-made object. It was flying over the Southern Ocean and looking south and seeing the Aurora Australis over the South Pole. I'd never seen that before, and it was just amazing to see this shimmering curtain of green light moving across the sky. Just absolutely breathtaking. We did not have fast film, so I could not photograph it, but it was just a spectacular sight.
Andy, what were you dreaming when you were in space?
That's actually an interesting question. I'd seem not to be able to remember my dreams. I must dream, because people do, but I don't generally remember them very well. And my dream habits seem to be the same on Mir as they were on the ground, and I just didn't recall a lot of my dreams. The one that did strike me, stand out, and that I remember quite clearly was, for some reason, I was thinking, maybe because I'd just flown over Australia or something, I had been thinking about my childhood in Adelaide, and I dreamed about that, and I dreamed being back in the house where I was raised and playing in the local street with the neighborhood kids and so on, but I was floating, and I had to say to them, excuse me, but I have to float. And that just stood out, that sort of connection between my past and what I was doing at the time. There's a psychologist in the audience, they can explain it to me. Yes?
Andy, I've got a three-part question, actually. On the Soyuz, or the Mir, were there compartments or airlocks that were built into it for survival reasons or anything? And also, I wondered, have they determined any long-term effects for your physiology after space flight?
Coming. Well, let's. While you think of the third one, let's go with the first one, airlocks. There's each of the modules has a hatch on it that you can close off and seal that module, so that if there's a depressurization in any one of the modules, you can immediately close the hatch and seal it. And that's what they did when the Spectre module depressurized. There's also a hatch on the Soyuz and effectively an airlock there that you can use if there's a major depressurization. You can go into that and close the hatch and be on the right side of the Soyuz and fly home. What was the second one? Oh, long-term physiology. The jury is still out on that issue. The Russians have got a lot of experience with it, and cosmonauts have flown up to a year and more, and thus far there appears to be no long-term physiological effect.
The time you spend in space, the longer you stay in space, does that mean it takes longer to recover from the weightlessness?
Yeah, it does, but it's not one for one. It sort of levels out after a while. I think if you spend 4 months in space or 6 months, probably not a whole lot of difference. But if you spend 1 month versus 4 months, there is a lot of difference. So the longer you're there, the more time you require, but it sort of levels out, it asymptotes out after a while.
Can I just ask a question that sort of follows on from that?
Yes.
Given that you've experienced an extended duration mission firsthand, how achievable do you believe a mission to Mars is, given that a lot of people are saying it could take up to 2 years flight time?
Yeah, actually it wouldn't take that long flight time. The scenarios we have for going to Mars have you going out on about a six-month one-way trip and landing there. And there's actually two scenarios. There's one mission that has you stay there until you get another favorable conjunction of Mars and Earth, which is like a 500-day stay on the surface of Mars, and then 6 months back. That's like a 2.5-year round trip for the whole thing. The other scenario is you go to Mars, 6 months there, spend just a real short time there, pick up a few rocks, jump in your ship and come back, and that's about a year, or let's say it's a year and a half or something. But that's perfectly feasible. What's not feasible is to, I think, have a crew person arrive at Mars and to be expected, having spent a lot of time in zero gravity, to fly a complicated landing like they did at the moon, manual landing or something, down onto the surface of Mars, because he's not going to have good balance, his eye-hand coordination's not going to be good, because he'll be feeling the effects of gravity, which are going to be messing him up. So you have to have a fully automated landing system, and then when the crew get there, they don't immediately go out. They have to wait a while and recondition themselves to the gravity before they start work. The way you can overcome that is by having a rocket which or a spaceship which has got artificial gravity, which you make by spinning it. Like you might have two halves to it and they're on a long cable and it spins end over end. You can actually create some artificial gravity that way and prevent some of these problems. So those are the kinds of scenarios that will be used to go to Mars. How it's going to play out remains to be seen.
Andy, my name's Lucian Green. Thought I'd introduce myself because no one else seems to be introducing themselves.
Thank you.
Do you perceive any special qualities for any future Mars astronauts?
Yeah, I think what you're going to need is people who are able to step up to diverse kinds of problems and do different things and understand things. You want someone who, for example, might be a good mechanic to repair things and also have medical skills help people who are injured or sick. So they've got that sort of wide range of abilities. Clearly, they're going to have to be people who interact well, have good social skills, and can work in confined space with other people being around them sort of 24 hours a day.
My question's about... I'm down here. Hello.
Oh.
just sort of about the human element of all this, like whilst obviously you've contributed enormously to research and science, I'm wondering whether you ever feel at times that you've had to then compromise in terms of other aspects of your life, whether it be, you know, family or relationships or friendships, or whether, you know, how do you get on with the normal day-to-day stuff that most of us do?
Yeah, no, I don't feel... I've been asked that before. I don't feel like I've had to compromise anything to do this. I have had to be very determined to get the position that I wanted, because these positions are very competitive. Having done that, though, I have a great sense of inner peace that I've done something that is extraordinary. I think of all the spaceflight activities that you could do, the last part of the 20th century, flying on a space station, a long-duration flight, is probably the preeminent one, and I'm myself lucky to have done that. There's only 7 US NASA astronauts that have done it, and to be one of those is really amazing. And I'm very proud that I've done that as a personal venture. Very privileged, actually.
Andy, over here. Down here.
Okay.
I'm representing Mater Christi College, and a lot of the students have come in this evening. We have a science unit that we teach on, we call it Out of This World. Our question tonight is, does Australia have any serious commitment to space exploration in the future? And will Australia be taking a tangible part in the International Space Station next year? In other words, what's Australia actually doing?
I wouldn't say that there is a very strong commitment in Australia right now, unfortunately, for some of these activities. It is good to see that some activity at Woomera is starting up with Kistler Aerospace for launching vehicles. Australia could, should they so desire, make a huge contribution to the world's space programs by virtue of its geography and the fact that it has equatorial regions and remote regions which are ideal for launch sites. For example, the Russians have a proton booster, which provides a good capability to Earth orbit, but they can't launch it near the equator. That seriously limits the performance of a rocket when you can't do that. You use the Earth's rotation to slingshot it up. There would be an enormous amount derived by having a launch site in Australia for launching rockets. It would just be a huge boost to the technical infrastructure of the social community within Australia. It would provide a source of inspiration for young people to understand engineering problems, to study these problems, and that skill that they would develop would infuse into society and the economy of society in a very positive way, and my mind in a way that would be much healthier than just arbitrarily sending money out to create a jobs program. I'm not running for office though. Second part of your question about the International Space Station, the ISS, is that Australia is not involved in that right now. But I am sensing that there is a community developing in Australia that thinks they perhaps should. And I think NASA is actually very receptive to that. So it wouldn't surprise me if that were to change. But it will require a lot of careful thinking on the part of the specialists in Australia in what direction the space station participation should be. But I think we might see something along those lines in the future, and that would be very good.
Andy, for any of the young people in this group who are thinking about having a career as an astronaut, are there any special qualifications that you need?
You need to have credentials, of course, which NASA looks for, which are technical credentials in some specialist field. Engineering is mine. Science, physics, biology, or medicine are other fields that are important careers for NASA. There is, of course, an alternative career path, which is through a flight program and become a trained test pilot, or there's even a mixture of both. The main thing that is needed is to be good at the field that you choose to do and enjoy it, because then you can make a contribution, and that would make your credentials attractive to NASA. Education is the key, though. Education is the key. I'm not sure that I can describe it better than perhaps some of the senses that I think these video sequences captured. It is a really interesting time in your life to be on your back, strapped into the vehicle, and you hear that count, 8, 7, 6, and then you feel the engine start, and everything's shaking, and it's noisy, and you get 5, 4, 3, you know, that last 6 seconds when they run the engines up to full speed, you're still tied to the ground, and you're waiting for the solid rockets to go. The longest 5 seconds, you know, time seems to get drawn out, and you just wonder what's going to happen. You're going to shut down the engines, go back to crew quarters and have a beer, try again the next day, or are you going to be in orbit? And then all of a sudden, there's this huge explosion, and everything lights up, and you're just on your way. And at that point, you know that you're going to orbit. And it is an extraordinary sensation to ride the space shuttle. It is probably, I would have to say, the preeminent experience that you can have, I think, in the 1990s, is to ride space shuttle. It's just as a sense of exhilarating speed. It is quite unbelievable. Yes?
Andy, what's the food like in space?
What's the food like in space? Food was good. We had Russian food and American food. I had a good selection of soups and vegetables, and had some canned foods, meat-based products. And they were really good. We had a good selection of fruit juices and tea and coffee and biscuits like that. And I enjoyed it. I had plenty of food. Up the back.
Andrew, you mentioned that you were watching a video during dinner. Can you say what the video was? And can you talk a bit about entertainment generally?
Yeah, we actually had a whole lot of videos. At dinner time, since it was the three of us, it would be usually a Russian video, where there were a lot of Russian movies, and we'd watch those. I also had my own selection of videos of movies, like you rented a video store, and I had about 70 of those on small cassettes. And so I would watch those in the weekend as recreation, and that was a lot of fun for me.